This evening, Darlene Cohen at Tassajara on May 18, 1998, is speaking on the teacher-student relationship.
Since you hear a lot in Zen about the teacher-student relationship, and many of us are here with our teachers this week, I'd like to talk about some aspects of that relationship. But first, you have to hear my story of my first quest for a Zen teacher. When my boyfriend Tony and I first came out from Boston to California, he came out specifically to go to Tassajara. And we had a big collie dog named Dylan. Dylan had been my constant companion for many years. We'd been through many adventures together, hitchhiking all up and down the East Coast, and we went to Woodstock together. And in that 300,000 plus crowd, we got separated and were miraculously reunited. And we came out to California with Tony and lived on communes with other dogs and kids and other people, so we were very close. Well, as I say, Tony and Dylan and I came out specifically to go to Tassajara. And the first thing we did was go to the San Francisco Zen Center and sit a 5-day sesshin, which was my first Zazen experience. Afterwards, one thing the sesshin did, it did many things, but it certainly reinforced our determination to go to Tassajara. So we went to the director of the building and said that we had come out from Boston to go to Tassajara, and could we please go? And the director said, well, I'm very sorry, but we don't allow dogs at Tassajara. You won't be able to take that dog. And we said, well, what would we do with our dog for so long a period of time? And he said, well, you should practice non-attachment and take him to the pound. So I burst into tears, and my boyfriend Tony was very angry. So we left them center determined to start our own Zen center called the Dylan Dog Zendo. And we went up to Chico, which was about 3 or 4 hours northeast of San Francisco, where my boyfriend Tony had friends, and we went up there to stay. And we built ourselves a little pond, and we sent mail order to Zen Center for Zafu. And we sat 4 times a day because that was the schedule posted on the Zen Center door. We didn't realize that people chose 1 or 2 of those options to sit. And our friends, who lived on this commune with us, they were into peyote and Indian sweat, and they ridiculed us constantly. But we were very determined. So I wrote a rich friend of mine in Boston saying that we needed money to start our own Zen Center. And he wrote back, pledging $45,000 if we would find a Zen master to live in our Zen center. Well, this seemed reasonable enough. But he and I thought, well, how is it that we're going to find a Zen master? I mean, I suppose they all are in Japan, and we don't know anything about Japan or where they keep them or anything. About the best we could do was drop a letter in the letterbox saying, to a Zen master who's willing to come to America, Japan. So we thought, well, I guess we'll just have to settle for an American master. But we were almost in the same place about finding an American Zen master. And it seemed unseemly to go to Zen Center and beg them for one of theirs. Since they only had 2, Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, and we wanted to establish an alternative to them anyway, so it was very unseemly to ask them for one. So we got the idea of advertising in the Chico paper, which had a very good circulation into Oroville and Red Bluff. And I can't remember exactly what the ad said. We did agree not to mention the $45,000, just in case it would attract mercenaries. But we did say, I'm pretty sure we said that the person had to be experienced. So we got only one reply. And he called for an interview and came over. And he was, I'd say in his 60s, and he was kind of rangy and balding, and he brought a teenage girl with him that I assumed was his disciple, although Tony had darker suspicions. And since we didn't know how to interview a Zen master, really, we just kind of chatted. It's very hot in Chico, so we talked about that. But then, and I tried to draw the teenage girl into the conversation, but she was very shy. And finally, this was going on, and I thought, well, we have to get to the heart of the matter pretty soon. So I asked him what his scheme was for getting people enlightened. And we told him that we were thinking of going down to San Francisco and going to monasteries, South Sahara, and sitting zazen until we got enlightened. And he said, don't fall for that rigid old fashioned stuff. He said, all you have to do is be here now. Just look around you. And I looked around me, but I didn't see anything that was particularly illuminating. So after he left, I said to Tony, do you think he was the real thing? And Tony said, well, I don't know, but I do think that no Zen master would put down zazen, even if it wasn't in his tradition. So I was very grateful for Tony's clarity. So we decided that if we didn't get another reply, that we would just go down to San Francisco and live in the city and try to convince the director to let us take Dylan to Tassahara. So we waited about a week or so, and we didn't get any more replies. So we did. We packed up and went down to San Francisco. We got jobs, got an apartment right near the building, and we sat zazen in the morning and the evening for about a year. And then when it came time to apply to the fall and winter practice period, we did. And I made sure to put on my application that Dylan had to go with me, and I enumerated his various good points, the fact that he could lie still for long periods of time, and that also he was very kind to other creatures. And sure enough, Tony and I were accepted to Tassahara along with Dylan. And when we got down to Tassahara, Baker Roshi said to me, well, we got Dylan's application, what about yours? And then he asked me whether Dylan was named after Bob Dylan or Dylan Thomas. And I thought, this is my first test from a Zen master. So I said that he was after C.W. Dylan, who was Secretary of the Treasury at the time, and his name was on $1 bill. And Baker Roshi did seem impressed. So Tony and I took very seriously this idea of having a teacher, because every book we ever read, every lecture we ever heard, emphasized this aspect of Zen practice. So it seemed to me that if you were going to study Zen, you would have rent, food, and a teacher. It was that simple. It was a staple. So I set about getting a teacher in the same way that I shop for groceries. And Baker Roshi was a premium brand because he was Suzuki Roshi's Dharma heir. And I had seen the mountain peak ceremony with my own eyes just before Suzuki Roshi died. I saw the ceremony making Baker Roshi his Dharma heir. So a few weeks after Suzuki Roshi died, I asked Baker Roshi to be my teacher. Now, to my mind, I was just getting things in place, just getting my teacher in place, just like my zafu and my zabaton was in place in the zendo. That's why I was surprised and moved, touched to this day, when he very seriously said, yes, I will be your teacher. And he said it with such seriousness and solemnity that I thought, oh God, now I've gone and done it. I really have to practice now. It was no longer in the fantasy realm. I had involved another person, and I wasn't sure at all what it involved to have a teacher, what he was supposed to do, or I was supposed to do, but I was very sure that I had just made a heavy commitment. And I assumed his job was to get me enlightened, and I was determined to help him in any way I could by sitting with him and counting my breath. Over the next several years, that relationship with Baker Roshi was pivotal to my life. It overrode all other relationships with relatives, friends, husband, child, all of them. And before that relationship, I had never known such intimacy with another person. I was totally willing to be known by him. I trusted that he accepted me the way that I was. And he sometimes was so direct with me that I would suddenly enter like an altered state, you know, his own. There was no social convention, just him and me relating directly. Even though in retrospect, our relationship was fraught with many difficulties and problems and projections on both sides, the fact that it seemed to be set in some place other than my personality remains one of the profound teachings of my life. So aside from the fact that every book and lecture, etc., advises you that you must have a teacher, that this is the paradigm for Zen practice, why would you have a teacher? What are the reasons that this be the paradigm for Zen practice? Well, I think it helps if you look at a teacher as like a good friend, or some of the books refer to a teacher as a spiritual friend. I think this helps take out some of the sense of infantilization that you might get from a permanent teacher-student relationship. I mean, you're both adults, and so it's kind of uncomfortable to have that permanent sense that somebody is higher than you. So if you think of this person as a spiritual friend, I think it helps to have that idea. You're both equal, and you're developing together a face-to-face intimacy. You hang out together, you might cook together, you take walks together, you discuss the nature of reality together, just like you do other friends, except that this friend, this spiritual friend, can help you by pointing out your blind spots, by challenging your assumptions, by listening to your observations. This person has years of meditation training on you, and they can see you from a very helpful, a very helpful perspective. They can interrupt your obsessive thinking, direct you and focus you. I think of practice as an exploration of our mind. The particular way that we manage to weave together a self, and then to artificially separate that self from the rest of the world. And I think it's very difficult to see the edges of that self without help. It's like you're trying to see your own blindness. You literally can't see what you can't see. And I think the insights that we might have in our practice that involve the insights about grasping and aversion, I think they involve some understanding or observation of the process by which we put together that self and then protect that delusion. So I think we need someone to bounce our ideas off of, someone to support us when we really need encouragement. So given that you might have a teacher, what are the qualities in a teacher that might be valuable to you? Well, first of all, I think that a teacher aligns themselves with the part of you that practices, the part of you that is not goal-oriented, that's not involved in gaining and losing, but the part of you that is not busy, the part of you that is not busy. There are many layers of it. Hidden, independent, dependent, calm, agitated, all sorts of things. And sometimes these layers, like a self-interested layer, and then a layer that can just not judge or see things as they are, sometimes these layers are in conflict, such as maybe you want to live a free life as an artist, creating whenever the spirit moves you, eating and sleeping whenever you want, but you think, well, I don't know, maybe I better take that 9-to-5 job with Bank of America. So they're conflicting selves. Or you decide that you're going to begin a practice of awareness of your breath. And so you sit down and begin to listen and to your breath and in your body. But after a few minutes you get bored and your mind wanders to more interesting things, like your plans for world domination, or your affair with Brad Pitt, or the project you're working on at work. So different parts of us want different things at the same time, and we're often in conflict. Your teacher aligns themselves with your way-seeking mind, the part of you that can see things as they are, the part of you that can get beyond your habits, your conditioned thoughts. It can get underneath them and beyond them. So many things might be happening at one time, and your teacher tries to align themselves with that part. For instance, maybe when you're stressed out, you have the habit of jumping into denial. Oh, it's okay, nothing's wrong. I don't feel anything. No, nothing. Don't worry about it. Don't bother. But there is some part of you still that actually wants to know what's going on, so it wants to have the experience that's available to you. So your teacher supports the part of you that is willing to stay in the suffering, that is willing to actually have the experience and doesn't want to close off. So since this teacher is supporting a part of you, it's very different from laying a Zen trip on you from the outside. From this point of view, a teacher can criticize your foibles and still be supporting you, a part of you. So this is very important. And a teacher might give you practices that you can begin to see yourself the way your teacher sees you. For instance, Baker Roshi gave me the practice of not criticizing anything for a year. And this is because I was constantly criticizing my own practice, constantly saying it wasn't good enough, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that, and he just said, don't criticize anything for a year. When you turn on a radio station, leave it there. When you see a movie, don't criticize it. When you eat a meal, that's the meal, just as it is. So a few minutes into this practice, I realized that almost every thought I had was criticizing something. I just suck the life out of everything constantly by criticizing it from some remote, aloof attitude. In fact, that very morning after that Dokusan, after that interview with him, I went down the stairs of Zen Center, across the street, up the stairs to my apartment. There was my husband sleeping while I was practicing. You know, and I thought, what a slut. Oh my God, I criticized everything. He also gave me the practice of assuming that I was an enlightened Buddha and that all my actions were the actions of an enlightened Buddha. And this directly addressed my very idealistic and judgmental practice, that I was always down here, an enlightened Buddha was always up here. And every time I did something, went to the toilet or dusted something in my room, or had a conversation with another person, I always had to see the gap that I set up between myself and a Buddha. So with the practice he gave me, I could see how idealistic I was, that no matter what I did, there was always this huge gap between me and a Buddha. So this is the kind of practices, the kind of help that your teacher can give you, so that you can see yourself in the same way that they do. Also, a good teacher does not reinforce the status differences between you. Even if you fall into putting teacher higher than you are, your teacher should very skillfully challenge that, whether directly or indirectly. Even, of course, there's a tremendous difference between you in meditation training, in years of training. But your teacher is encouraging you to do your practice to become him or her. They're encouraging you to find your practice and using that training to help you find your path, not to make you into them. Suzuki Roshi was so adored and adulated that one time he called his students in to look at his bowel movement in the toilet. And he said, "See, I'm just like you." I got the impression that he never put himself above anyone else. In fact, the very first time I ever saw him, I was going down the stairs to the Zendo in the San Francisco Zen Center, and he was coming up, and I knew who he was, and I thought, oh, I couldn't possibly, I am so insignificant, I couldn't possibly waste even a moment of his time. And he was flanked by two attendants who seemed to share that opinion. So I scrunched myself, my body, into a small space on the stairs so I possibly could, and gave a wide berth to the three of them as they started to pass. But Suzuki Roshi would have none of that. He stopped completely and bowed to me, thereby forcing his two attendants to do the same. And he bowed long and low to me. And of course I returned it. And while I bowed, my body settled into its place on the stair, and so did my mind. And I was suddenly completely at ease, lacking nothing, meeting Suzuki Roshi straight across at the distance. So in the first moment that I ever met Suzuki Roshi, he was already challenging my assumptions. Even if you're a brand new student, just in the door, you deserve the respect of a student on the way, a student of the way. So the question comes up, how much of a role model should your teacher be for you? After all, we all have different styles of teaching or different styles of Zen practice, each one of us. Your teacher is not you, and you are not your teacher. So everyone has their different style. So you mustn't confuse your teacher's personal style with Zen practice itself. So I think it actually helps to have several teachers, or at least a couple teachers at first, so that you don't fall into that confusion. But I do, there are a couple of respects in which your teacher and other Zen practitioners around you can be a role model for you. And one is that their actions and deeds are go together. They're consistent. They're not like your parents. They do what they say, and vice versa. They say what they do. And another way that I think is very important for anyone, not just your teacher, to inspire you, is that they are capable of behavior and often model behavior that goes beyond habit, that goes beyond social convention. And if you know someone that this is true of, then you have a teacher of the heart, a teacher that encourages you to follow your heart, even though it's against the expectations of culture, the wider culture, or our community itself. I had support from my teachers for some very eccentric practices that it would have been impossible to do without their support, because they brought mild disapproval from other members of the community. For instance, a mentor of mine in San Francisco took his son to a basketball game instead of going to a conference for Zen scholars that he was expected to attend. And also, recently I attended a small meeting of the friends and students of a teacher who's known nationally, but he's on the brink of great things, of becoming a household word, a household name. And he shared with us his dilemma He has been invited by senators and CEOs to give mindfulness retreats in the Bahamas and in Washington, all this kind of thing. And of course, he wants to spread the Dharma, especially in such corridors of power where one might like to think that he actually needed. But he also is stretched to his limit already. He has two young children. Family is very important to him. His private time is very important to him. These are the things that nurture him. And so he's concerned about this. And he shared his concern with those of us who were there. It's really touched me that he didn't knee-jerk go for it. That he was considering it in such a serious way. So I said to him, I said, if you disregard your state of mind and put aside the things that nurture you, that make you of value to other people in order to spread the Dharma, which is an idea, spreading the Dharma. If you do this, I personally will be very demoralized. And he was very touched by that, and he thanked me. Now, this doesn't mean that he can't do both, but I think he wanted was some support for that part of him that goes against all of our cultural ideas. Of course you go for it. Of course you go to Washington and see the senators. Of course you go meet the CEOs. So we can inspire each other when we need to make decisions go against the grain. And this is very important for your teachers and your Sangha to do, not just your teachers. That your Sangha can support and inspire you in this way too. And I think you'd be very lucky to have different teachers at different stages of your practice, as I have been. My relationship with Baker Roshi was a very dramatic relationship. I was young and I wanted my life to be full of drama and adventure and political intrigue. And he was very interested in those things as well. He used to say, another day, another drama. And he was the teacher for me at that time. It was always exciting, always a whirlwind around him, always some, you know, famous person coming in and having he would have these little parlors or what it's called. So it was very exciting. And even though I could see he had many flaws that less flamboyant teachers didn't have, like he was very ambitious, he was arrogant and self-indulgent, but this was right alongside his great vision of Buddhism in America as including everyone, mothers, cripples, everyone, and his great ability to focus, his genuine compassion. And I thought to myself, if he can practice with all his faults, so can I. I was never attracted to teachers who were virtuous. After he left Zen Center, I continued my practice without a teacher for many years, but I was a mature student when he left. And by that I mean that I could practice without the encouragement of someone else. And I made my own judgment calls. I didn't expose my practice to other people. And I became over the years aware of a yearning to share my practice, even though I was afraid it would be revealed as very self-indulgent. So I thought, how do I return to a teacher-student relationship? I hesitated to take up the time of other people because by this time I was unable to get cross-legged because of arthritis, and I thought that my practice was probably too unique to have any value to anyone else. So I hesitated to take up the time of people who could train people who could sit cross-legged and sit long sessions. But then when I was asked to be Shuso, which is head student of a practice period, I was very happy to come back and course in the fast lane of practice. Even though I thought it might be somewhat humiliating, I thought, well, it's worth it. It's worth it to go back and practice with people again. And when I was Shuso, I thought with great pleasure how vast and incomprehensible practice is when you practice with other people. You never get a handle on it. It's constantly frustrating and unsettling. to have other people. C, your practice. And now I have many teaching relationships with many people at Zen Center and my Sangha in the North Peninsula. And they aren't so dramatic as the relationships with Baker Roshi, but they're very tender and sweet, respectful and friendly, stimulating and inspiring. And if I were to pick out any one thing in my life before, it would be for such friends, to have these friends. And meeting with them, both at Zen Center and in San Bruno, is always the high point of my life. So I think my valuing people like this reflects my practice now, my acceptance of not knowing, not attaining. Practice is a way of life rather than its entertainment, or a koan to be solved. And this way of life, developing intimacy with another person, and cultivating a willingness to be exposed, to be revealed, to be known to other people, has made my life very rich. And I wish you too the comfort and the inspiration of a good friend or two.